You're listening to Bits of Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I give you a very emotional chat full of tears and tissues. I spoke to Anna Fitzgerald, a mother of three, about her pregnancies and three premature births. We talk about what it's like to go into birth way too early, what being on bed rest for 8 weeks is like, their extended periods in NICU, and the severely lacking mental health supports for mothers like her. Season 2 of Bits of Me possibly wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the patrons who support the podcast. From €2 a month, you can become a patron as well and get early access to podcasts, monthly writing, and a Bits of Me badge. Go to patreon.com/bitsofme to sign up. But now, Anna Fitzgerald. Do you want to tell me about your first pregnancy and birth?
Sure. Yeah. So my first pregnancy was back 9 years ago now at this stage. And yeah, it was very much, we were sort of just a few months after getting married and, you know, all good. And we got pregnant very quickly and didn't think, you know, I suppose you don't know what's involved in pregnancy until you actually get pregnant. Yeah. You never really know what's around the corner. So yeah, with that pregnancy, I was feeling fine. I did have couple of bleeds during the pregnancy, so I did have a couple of overnights in Holles Street, but you know, I wasn't worried at all about it. It was very much, you know, just these bleeds, that it happens, it can happen to some people right the way through pregnancy. So didn't think much of it until then. I think I had a bleed and I was in hospital, and you know, you sort of have your scans like, okay, everything's fine, the baby's good. And then actually I remember they're like, well, do you want an internal examination? And I was like, well, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know what, you know, I suppose I just wanted to check, you know, that cervix was still closed, I assume. So so I had the internal examination and they said, oh yeah, everything looks fine. And so I was discharged. And then on the way home, I remember getting these pains and I was like, oh, right, okay. But I really wanted to get home to my own bed for a night. Yeah. So during that night, I was having a few like pains and cramps. And I was like, oh, this is not great. And, you know, they started to become more regular. So
and how far along were you at that stage?
At that stage, I was 32 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, so we called anyway and sort of explained what was going on. And they're like, yeah, come in. So that morning we went in and they were like, oh yeah, you know, it could just be Braxton Hicks, or, you know, it could just be false alarm. So I remember my mom coming into me and she was like, Anna, I think you're actually in labor. Yeah. Like, I think they sort of tried to like go, oh no, you'll be fine. You know, it's probably just a false alarm. And then, you know, as they become more and more intense and closer together, they're like, oh yeah, okay, I think you are in pre-labor. So Emily was born at 32 weeks, and yeah, it was, I suppose, for people who've had prem babies, to be born at 32 weeks is considered an older prem, you know. So there was never really any worry about her breathing, her lungs, her, you know, eyes, her development. So she's just spent sort of a day or two in the higher intensity NICU and then went into the special care unit, and then, you know, she was home within 3 weeks. So she was 35 weeks when she got home, and she was her dream child, slept lots. So that was, you know, whilst it was definitely, you know, not the ideal pregnancy or delivery or anything like that, she was healthy, she was great, and, you know, sort of didn't think twice about, you know, I suppose it wasn't for me a really anxious time, because everything went so smoothly in terms of, you know, she touched all the milestones that she was supposed to while she was in the special care unit. So, so that was my first pregnancy. And then after that, we had an early miscarriage just about a year after Emily was born, which, you know, we were going on holidays and I had some bleeding. I was like, well, I'm still going on holiday. So I had the miscarriage during the holiday.
All right.
So, you know, I think because it was so easy to conceive, we were like, okay, you know, it was tough, and but we were like, okay, let's, you know, just try again. So, you know, we got pregnant quite quickly after that. I think it was only like a couple of months after that, on our second child, Liam. So Liam's pregnancy was just textbook. I was feeling fine. I did the midwife scheme. So I did, most of the appointments were just with midwives. So like I was literally at my work Christmas party on a Friday night, and I was 31 weeks pregnant and up on the dance floor and all that. And then the following Saturday, I was just uncomfortable, and my waters just broke that Saturday night, and went into labour, and Liam was born, 31 weeks. So he was like, because he was a boy as well, he was a bit trickier. Girls tend to develop better as prems than boys for whatever reason. So because he was a boy and he was a week earlier than Emily, the journey was a little bit, it was longer. He was 6 weeks in the NICU.
Yeah.
And it took him a while to come off oxygen. And then I remember one stage, they thought he had some type of infection, so he needed an IV drip.
But what was that time like when he was in the NICU? I mean, for how much of that time were you there all the time? That 6 weeks is a long time.
Yeah, it's funny because it didn't feel like a long time to me. I think, and even looking back now, I would say 6 weeks in the NICU isn't long compared to, you know, what I went through on the third. But I think because I'd done it before and I sort of knew what to expect, and I met some really great moms as well whilst I was in the NICU, and who had all their own journeys and their stories, which were also so inspiring. So I think with Liam, you know, we had Emily at home, and, you know, she was going to a little play school in the morning. So we sort of dropped Emily off, went into the NICU. Like, I was pumping consistently throughout this. So you sort of, even during the night, you wake up.
Yeah,
you set your alarm clock for every 3 hours and you pump, and then you bring the milk into the NICU. Sort of, for me, actually, I felt pumping was sort of what kept you being very much aware, like sort of, OK, I do have a babe, you know, that sort of.
Yeah.
Kept me ticking over. So I think it was because, once again, I never thought he was in any danger, as in, you know, I sort of said, okay, well, he was 31 weeks. Absolutely, there'd be bumps in the road, and there was, you know, days where, not that you'd think he wouldn't make it, but you just get setbacks. You're like, oh, he could be in here for longer. But yeah, it's sort of, and because it was winter as well, he was born in December. It was just, you know, it's sort of miserable, and you know, there's obviously more flus and infections going around. So when you bring a young baby home, you're sort of, you know, super sterile. Everything is sterile. And, you know, we were hand sanitizing before COVID even happened. So we were well used to, you know, keeping everything as sanitized as possible. So I think with Liam, I was sort of, I was fine. I because he was that bit old, 31 weeks, and my pregnancy had been absolutely fine. I took a couple of visits, you know, with my consultant, and then a couple with the midwife, and it was happened so quick, and he didn't really have time to think about it or worry about it. So by the time he got home, we were sort of, you know, in a routine, and, you know, we sort of knew the lay of the land, you know, what it's like to bring home a prem baby. So that was Liam. And then about a year after Liam was born, we had another miscarriage, which this one was tougher because, you know, I was feeling like wrecked, you know, sort of really tired. So I always thought, if you're feeling wrecked, that's a good sign, you know, sort of babies, like, you know, all is good with the pregnancy. But when we went in for our 12-week scan, there was no heartbeat. Well, actually, no, there was a faint heartbeat. They were asking us, oh, had you got your dates right? You know, just, you know, was the baby actually younger than we thought? And I was, you know, pretty sure, saying, actually, no, I think, you know, we are pretty much the 11 weeks, the 12 weeks. So for that week, I remember, like, they were saying it wouldn't be a feasible pregnancy. I, like, as in, whilst there was a faint heartbeat, it wasn't sort of where it should be. But obviously at that time, which was 2013, the option, like, I suppose for me at that point, the best option would be that the heart would actually stop, because then you could have a DNC. So I remember for that week, it was, we were in limbo because, you know, you were sort of hoping, OK, maybe I've got the dates wrong. But knowing that actually, I don't think I have. But then sort of hoping, well, I don't want to go back in a week's time. And then for still to say, yeah, the baby isn't developing, but there's still a faint heartbeat. And you're like, well, you know, what's that supposed to mean? Like, you're supposed to wait until the heart stops and then you can sort of get DNC and stuff. So it's terrible to say, but luckily we went in a week later and they said actually there was no heartbeat. So I had a DNC for that, which, you know, it was tough, but we had two healthy babies at home. So, you know, they very much keep you going, I think, you know, when you do have a miscarriage and you have a child, children at home, and very much a family, you know, I think I was very much like, okay, that's happened, you know, we don't have problems getting pregnant, you know, let's just be thankful and be happy for the kids we have.
Am I right as well in thinking that after Liam was born, was there any kind of investigation with regards to the reasons why you'd had two very premature babies? Like, they took samples of your placenta, did they?
Yeah, that's right. So my placenta was sent off, and nothing really came out of either of those tests that they did on it. So I think, having spoken to a consultant after, he was very much, well, maybe that's just your term. Like, maybe, you know, that's as far as you could carry children, you know. There was no reason, you know, there was no medical reason they could give for me having prem babies.
And you weren't kind of given any warnings or any sense of, like, you know, this needs to be kept an eye on. It was just, you know, checked and that was that.
Yeah, well, definitely, like, after Emily, the placenta was sent off and was checked, and there was no reason for it. And I remember asking before we tried for our second, you know, was there any risk, you know, of the next baby being premature? And they were like, it was very much, you know, because you just had one, there is no sort of pattern. And I didn't really read up on it because I don't like to read up too much on things because I think you can scare yourself.
Yeah.
But I think subsequently I've read up and there is a higher risk if you've had, if your first baby is prem. There is a higher risk. Now, it's a very small risk, but it's obviously, you know, it could be like 2% and then it's up to 4% or something like that. But there is still, you know, a higher risk that you will have another premature baby. So, yeah, so that's sort of where we got to after Liam. And before we actually tried to have baby number three, I did meet with the consultant just to discuss the risks of having a much more prem baby because, you know, at that stage I was like, if there was a high risk that I would have a very prem baby, we'd just probably call it, you know, be thankful for the two children we had. And I think his advice is very much usually what happens if you have multiple prem babies, that they tend to get a bit older. So you might have a 30-week-old, then the next one could be 31 or 32. So he said that's like the evidence of past mothers giving birth to prem babies, that's sort of the evidence. But also every pregnancy is different, so he couldn't say, you know, you can't say, oh yeah, you know, you'd be fine. Like, it's,
of course,
you have to, you know, a pregnancy, regardless, even if you've had a perfectly normal healthy baby in your first pregnancy, every pregnancy carries risks and you just don't know what's in store. So we did decide to go again, and then we had that miscarriage. And then, you know, very quickly afterwards, I became pregnant again. So we were delighted. And but this pregnancy was also, it was difficult from the start. I had a few bleeds from the beginning, so a good few scares. And you sort of, you know, you're going into Hollis Street and you're like, oh, please, like,
yeah,
hope you sort of hope that, you know, the heartbeat's still there. So every time we had a scare, we sort of went in and luckily heartbeat was still there and they're like, oh yeah, all's good, all's fine. So then at 20 weeks, I remember being in a meeting in work and just, I suppose throughout the, I was sort of, either there was blood passing, you know, so I was sort of constantly aware of, you know, just what, you know, stuff going on. So I sort of felt there had been some liquid passed, but it was clear this time. And I was like, oh, that's really unusual. So I went into Hollis Street and they're like, oh, right. I still had, you know, a bit of a bump and there was still fluid there. So they thought, oh, not sure what it was. So they did take a sample of the fluid and it was actually my waters had broken.
And that was how many weeks gone were you?
That was at 20 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So like it went from very much, oh yeah, you know, you look fine. There's still fluid around the baby too. They did the test and were like, okay, just to let you know, your waters have broke. So most likely baby will be delivered in the next 48 hours. And, you know, obviously 20 weeks wouldn't survive. So, you know, that was obviously devastating to hear. So we went home and just collected sort of an overnight bag. So I went and stayed for two nights in Hollis Street. And luckily I did get I'd gone private on this pregnancy because, you know, I thought I was worth it. So we did get a private room, which, you know, was really helpful because unfortunately for other mothers, you know, you're in a ward with women who are actively giving birth. And, you know, you're effectively losing your baby. So, you know, I think it's for me, it's something obviously that needs to be addressed with the new maternity hospital that I think even like I remember my husband came to collect me after the 48 hours. And he brought my two kids and up in the lift, you know, in Hollis Street, there's one lift. They're going up the lift. You know, people in the lift are like, oh, so you're going to collect your new little baby brother or sister. And my husband was just like, oh, my God, if only they knew what, you know, what we were being there for. So I think, you know, anyone who I've spoken to, you know, who's gone through loss in Hollis Street, it's very difficult to be surrounded by, you know, couples bringing their new baby home in the car seat. So
it's awful.
So yeah, so that was really tough. And I remember for those 48 hours, I didn't know anything about, you know, waters breaking early. Like for me, like as in early, obviously new for viable pregnancies, but I'd never really heard of waters breaking that early. So I looked it up online. And I was very, like, there was a few forums and, like, there were some moms and they were like, oh, yeah, my waters broke at 19 weeks, 20 weeks. And unfortunately, the baby passed away. Others were like, waters broke, but actually managed to hold on until, you know, 28, 29 weeks. So at that point, I was like, OK, I'm holding on to this baby. And I actually just visualised 28 weeks. So I said to myself, OK, like I remember it, like it was like keep drinking lots of fluid. So I was drinking lots and lots of water in for those 48 hours just to try and replenish the fluids that I was losing. Yeah. So I definitely was very much, okay, this baby's going to be fine. I'm gonna, like, just, you know, my head, regardless what everything else that was being said to us externally or by the hospital, I was like, I'm going to keep this baby for 28 weeks. That's my goal. That's what I'm going to get to.
What were they saying to you? Were you given kind of a clear message at all? Or
the message was that, you know, the initial message was that I would most likely go into labour within the 48 hours. So that's why I spent those two nights in Hollis Street. And then after that, it was just to expect labour pains, you know, to expect it any time. And, you know, we were given some bereavement brochures as well that I didn't look at. So I gave to my husband. I was like, you can read through those because I'm not even going there. And I remember actually some of the nurses saying, once there's a heartbeat, you know, you shouldn't be getting it. Like, you know, why would you be giving a family this when there's still a heartbeat there? But I think the chances of keeping the baby were so low. Like, you know, it was, because even my consultant said to me, like afterwards, after I'd given birth, that he was very conscious of how negative he was to us. So when another woman came and her waters had broken early, he was saying, oh, you know, well, there is actually a mom in there at the moment whose baby's in the NICU. And she managed to hold on. But then he said to me, but unfortunately, you know, she went into labour soon after her waters broke. So the reality is, and medically is, that it's very, very rare that you would keep the baby. But yeah, so after the 48 hours, you know, I was given the option. I could obviously stay in Holles Street until baby arrived, or I could go home and just be under bed rest. So the consultant was very much, you know, I think because the viability of the baby, it wasn't viable at that stage. He was like, there's no real point in staying in hospital because you have two kids at home. So you might as well be at home and then just come in, because we live very close to Holles Street. So like, I think if I'd maybe been, you know, 27 or 28 weeks, I might have been kept in so that, you know. So I think I was sent home very much on alert that I could start getting contractions at any point in time. So I went home and, yeah, basically I was 8 weeks at home on bed rest, you know, couldn't pick up the kids, couldn't, like, just got up, went to the sofa, had breakfast, went, you know, just watched TV, had lunch with the kids, back to the sofa. So it was definitely, for those 8 weeks, you were sort of living from week to week, you were sort of hoping, obviously, for each, I was going in for weekly appointments. So you're sort of living for the weekly appointments that you'd be like, heartbeat would be there. And then they'd be always checking for fluid around the baby. So basically, my fluid kept draining. So it's incredible, like the human body, like the fluid keeps replenishing around the baby. Yeah. So when I went in for my weekly scans, they'd be like trying to like measure these tiny little pockets of fluid, like, oh, great news. You have like 3 centimeters of fluid here. Or, you know, the way, as opposed to a baby should be floating around in fluid. As like, you know, as you have your big bump. So that was, you know, it was really tough. But then I'd a lot of hope. And, you know, definitely, you know, as I got to 24 weeks and then 25, the viability of the baby was increasing. And I remember just thinking, even to get the maternity leave, because, you know, if you go into labor before, I'm not sure if it's a 24 or 25 weeks, you know, if you do go into labor before, then you don't get maternity leave. You know, so, you know, the thought of just having maybe 2 weeks sort of grievance time and then, you know, going straight back into work, I was like, oh god, I couldn't even imagine that. So so definitely, I remember that 24 and 25 week, just having sleepless nights going, you know, hold on, like keep the baby in. So then after that, like, I'm a very active person and I love being out and about. So sort of get, I definitely, you know, you're sort of, I remember I drove the car one of the days to get an NCT or something. And like, my husband was like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm getting fed up here, you know. And she's like, you know, keep it simple. And then, you know, we're sort of coming into Christmas and stuff. So, you know, you're sort of trying to, you know, get Christmassy for the kids and get into the spirit. So then just before Christmas, I started feeling some contractions. And so went in, and I remember the week, just the few days before, I'd gone in for my weekly scan and they'd said to me that the baby was still breech. So just be prepared that if I did start to go into labour, I would have to have a C-section, which like my other two were natural deliveries. So, and I hadn't thought of that. So then I knew when I started getting contractions, I knew in my mind, okay, I'll have to get a C-section. Whereas I think if I didn't know that, I would have been a bit in shock. So I went into, I had some contractions and I went in, and Fionn was born at 28 weeks and 3 days, I think it was. And, you know, it was a C-section, so very different experience to the other two. And we didn't know the sex of the baby. And I remember when he arrived, you know, we were hoping it was a girl purely for that it would be an easier journey for him. Like, we sort of knew that, okay, if it was a boy, it'd be much tougher. And then we're told, oh, it's a boy. And we just looked at each other going, it's going to be a long journey. So Fionn was born, at 28 weeks and 3 days. And, you know, he was very, very sick. Like, because I hadn't the fluid around him for those 8 weeks, he literally had the lungs of a 24, 25 weeker as opposed to a 28 weeker. So that was like our main battle, was to get his lungs strong again. And we had an amazing pediatrician, a neonatologist, and she said to me, she was like, if he survives the next 48 hours, you'd be grand. We'll be over the worst of it. So then that was for me another sort of a goal. I was like, right, if we get past these 48 hours, that's it. And what definitely wasn't the case, you know, because you don't know what will happen. You don't know what turns a prem baby will take. But it was definitely in my head, I said to myself, OK, if he gets through these next 2 days, he's going to come home with us. So, you know, he did. He was so sick. His lungs were so underdeveloped. There was nitrix or something like that. There was a special machine that they needed. And we were so lucky because the machine had actually been used on a baby before Fionn was born and hadn't been cleared away yet. So literally when he was born, it was there ready for him to go on pretty much straight away. So definitely the experience with him, I think anybody with, you know, a very prem baby, you know, who's say 24, 25 weeks, you know, will tell you it's a scary time. Like it's, you just feel so helpless, like, and we're so lucky, like the facilities they have here in Ireland, we were lucky to be, you know, in Dublin and in the National Maternity Hospital. You know, the staff, the equipment, like everything that they have is just, you know, it just makes you realise how lucky we are to live in Ireland. And I always think, you know, if I lived in a less developed world, a country, I mightn't have any children at this stage. You know, that's the reality of it. And we are so lucky to live in Ireland and to have these amazing services. So my experience with Fionn was definitely, you know, full on. It was being surrounded by very, very sick babies as well in the NICU.
Yeah.
You know, it was the highest dependency level. And he was so sick at the beginning, like he couldn't even take my my colostrum and then my breast milk. Like they had to sort of feed him with nutrients, like sort of nutrients, and then like slowly build him up to take like the tiniest amounts of milk, like just you're talking like milliliters, and you're sort of that was definitely you know, a whirlwind, because you know, you don't know if there is permanent damage, you don't know what, like, so there's obviously lots of brain scans that they have, you know, in terms of his lungs, how would they develop, would he have any like long-term illnesses. So he was in total 10 weeks in the NICU with various, you know, good days and bad days, weight gains, you know, sort of weight losses, off oxygen, on oxygen. You know, you start up on CPAP, which is even like stronger, I think, trying to get oxygen into their lungs.
Yeah.
So like the experience is just so full on. And but we got through it. Like it was 10 long weeks, and he came home at the end of it. And like he's four now, and he's definitely living up to his his name. We called him after John McCool because he is a fighter and he's scrappy and he will fight, you know, his older brother and sister for anything and everything. And I think we're probably all afraid of him, you know, but, you know, he is strong as an ox, like touch wood now. I can't remember the last time he was even in the GP, like he's super strong. So, yeah, so it's sort of, it's only now, like he's four, that you sort of can look back and be like, wow.
Yeah.
That's just a mad journey, like just absolutely crazy.
Now, you've talked about the amazing care that you received in the NICU, but I suppose that's very much focused on the baby at that stage. What was it like for you and what kind of support did you and your husband get through all of this?
Yeah, and I think this is where I really, you know, I really want to shine a light because we're very lucky. We have grandparents really close to us, both sets, and brothers and sisters. And my dad was like a taxi service. You know, he used to drop me into Hall Street every morning and collect me. Because obviously after the C-section, you can't drive. Mm. So, you know, and I really do feel like if I didn't have that, my journey would have been very, very different. And, you know, my mental health would have suffered so much more. But even having said that, with all those supports, with all that love, you know, for me, it's like such a traumatic experience. Mm. Like anyone who's had like a prem baby or even a baby who's very sick and needs, you know, medical attention, you go into like you're on this heightened alert, sort of like your sort of senses are all heightened. I think it's probably cortisol. There's some various negative sort of hormones that, you know, the sort of, so you're literally go into emergency. You're on a state of emergency all the time.
Yeah.
You're being told all this crazy medical information about your baby. You know, you're just like, oh, well, I just want him to survive. So that's, you know, I remember afterwards he'd come home. I think that's for a lot of people and for myself, it's when they come home that you start to process what actually went on.
Mm.
Because whilst they're in there, like I was very much just, okay, focused, get milk into him, you know, make sure to strengthen him up. As they say, breast milk, you know, in particular for prem babies is just like better than any medicine they'll get, you know, which is, and it's because it's specific to them.
Yeah.
So any of the nutrients they need as a prem baby, like you'll be giving them.
Mm.
So you're sort of focused on that. So you're like every 3 hours you're expressing. So when you get them home is when it's the first time you can sort of breathe and, you know, take stock on what's happened.
Yeah.
And I remember go down to the local public health nurse. There was a breastfeeding morning and like all the babies could be weighed. And we'd go for coffee then afterwards. And, you know, I remember one of those just telling my story. You know, the way you sort of, when you have a prem baby, if you go into like mad details of someone asks how old they are and you're like, oh, well, like he's 4 months, but he's really only 1 month corrected.
Yeah.
Like it's all this mad stuff and people just look at you going, okay, like, so, you know, and that brings up, but I was really upset one of the days. I remember one mom going, oh, you know, there's a psychiatrist in Hollis Street that you can go to. And I'd never even heard, like, that was the first I'd heard of that. Like of all the weeks I'd spent on Hollis Street, it was never said to me, oh, listen, you know, why don't you go in for a chat and just, you know, to see how you're doing.
Even at your 6 week checkup, none of that was mentioned.
Never, never. So it was only that mom said to me that I went, okay, hold on a second. You know, one day I was just feeling really weepy and I said, okay, I'm going to ring my GP and I'm going to get referred to see the psychiatrist. And went to my GP and they did, you know, I think there's some questionnaire, I don't know what it's called, around, you know, postnatal depression.
Yeah.
That you have to fill out. And, you know, for me, it was more anxiety and even like post-traumatic stress, like that PTSD where you're like just processing a really traumatic event that's happened in your past. And then also, I suppose, dealing with all the postnatal hormones and all that.
Mm.
So I went to see him and, you know, there's one psychiatrist. Well, at the time, there was one psychiatrist and he was on holidays. So they were very much, oh, we're really sorry, but the only appointment we can give you is in, say, a week and a half time. And for me, you know, I knew it was anxiety, but if it was much more serious,
yeah,
I was a bit like, you know, if I actually felt suicidal or like, and they're like, okay, well, we can book you in for a week and a half. I just feel like, who are we actually focusing? Like, we're very much focused on the physical health,
yeah,
of the baby, which, you know, is obviously the key priority. But, you know, I really do think, you know, why are we not focusing on the mental health of women who not only, like, for, in my instance, it was prem babies, but in other cases, you know, who have traumatic births, who have any type of trauma. It might be a normal birth, but they have some childhood trauma. It could be anything.
Yeah.
Part of our, you know, discharge process should be consulting with a counsellor or somebody that you can just talk to, just so they can see, okay, how is this person doing? How is this mom doing? And I think definitely any parent, and I think it's both for men and women, like any parent whose kid goes through the NICU should absolutely get mental health support. Like, it should be part of your baby's discharge. Like, I went to, they did like how to bathe your baby, like talks in Holles Street, how to, like, you know, if to do CPR, you know, all that side of it, you know, which was amazing and, you know, important that you know all this. But I just think the whole mental health side of is completely ignored. Like, it's, you know, and the staff there are amazing. You know, their jobs are to obviously look after the physical health of both the mom and the baby. But I really think, what are we doing about mental health? What about women's mental health? You know, and we've seen over the last few weeks, you know, with the mother and baby homes, at the cervical checkout, like screening process, you know, a controversy that women's mental health is just, the supports are just not there. I know they're improving, and I know that, you know, I've been to a couple of talks around how they're going to roll out better supports. But, you know, we're just so far behind. I look back and I just go, if I didn't have my family around me, my friends, I'm back in an area where I grew up, so I have lots of really close childhood friends. Like, if I came here, like, from a different country and I, you know, met an Irish man or whatever, and, you know, I didn't have those supports, I think my story would be very, very different. Like, you know, I think that's something that I definitely will be focusing on in future, is to try and shine a light on postpartum mental health and being proactive and having those talks with women before they leave the hospital, as opposed to waiting months down the line until the woman actually realized herself she's a problem, like, you know, that there is an issue there. It should be talking through in the system that you can, you know, process your thoughts. Because for me, I think if I have a prem baby, it's something that will always stay with you. Like, you'll always carry it. And I'd love to have a set of tools that you go, okay, when you're talking about it, here's a way that you can, you know, without getting upset or letting your emotions come to the front, that, like, you can sort of talk about it. And then another part of me goes, well, I've always been super emotional. So, you know, I think I made a reference to that, you know, I was a child in the cinema watching E.T. when I was, you know, 6 or 7, who had to leave the cinema because I was just bawling my eyes, crying, this poor little white alien that was about to die. So definitely, you know, I've always been very emotional. But these experiences of having prem babes definitely tips you over into like a whole new level of emotion. But any, like, even when I on Facebook forums around, like, the Irish Neonatal Health Alliance, people, like, if you have a prem baby and, you know, you're marking milestones in the future, be it, you know, the first birthday or a communion or, you know, an 18th or whatever the case may be, you always, you know, have in the back of your mind, you know, the start of your child's life, you know, how difficult it was at the start. So, so that's sort of, it's something that I'll carry with me, but hopefully I'll be able to be less emotional about it in a few years' time. Oh.
How has your anxiety and your mental health been in the years since Fionn was born and coming up to now?
I think the last year in particular, I've sort of got back to do, you know, my own things. I love running. I'm doing sea swimming. Like, I found that I've actually got more time, like I have like time to myself to do all this. And it's only when I talk about the experience that I really get emotional. I suppose on a day-to-day basis, it's a really busy house. Like, you know, the kids are like, have all their different, you know, emotions that you meet. And like, I love going out and meeting my friends, and we travel a lot. So overall, my mental health is great.
Yeah.
But when I talk about it, it's when I get really emotional still.
And of course.
It's 4 years on now, and, you know, I'm obviously still emotional about it, but that's only like, it's when I'm talking about it, whereas usually you don't talk about this on a daily basis. It's very much life goes on, kids are growing up every year, each year, you know, they're going through their own milestones of starting school or, you know, learning to ride a bike or whatever the case may be. So they're all going through all those milestones.
Mm.
You definitely look at them and like, there's times you sit back and you go, oh wow, isn't it? Like, you know, we're so lucky. And, you know, I'm sure look at me from the outside, like people are like, oh wow, look at that, like, literally this kid's 8, 6 and 4 now. So it's very much, oh wow, she's the ideal family, like it must have been all great. And, you know, so externally, you know, the end result has been an amazing family, super healthy, happy kids. But the journey to get here has definitely been a struggle. And like, you know, it's definitely, it's not an easy journey. Like, I think anybody, even if you have the most normal births and healthy kids from the get-go, you know, not it's always a hard journey to raise kids. But just to have that, such a big challenge to get them even to come home with you is... definitely, you know, I'm very grateful for my kids, but I'm very much aware, like, I suppose I'm more aware of other people's struggles to have children. I have some very good friends and we've been open around, you know, talking about our miscarriages or, you know, any mental health or, you know, relationship breakdowns, whatever the case may be. And I'd love to see that openness becoming more the norm in our society, that we can talk about miscarriages, we can talk about, you know, single parenting, we can talk about how tough it is to bring up children, and that can be talked about and not sort of brushed under the carpet like traditionally we've tend to do. So yeah, that's...
You're very wise for having tissues there at the ready. I didn't have any. Makeup all over my face.
Well, yeah, well, I always have tissues all over the house. Just, it's a thing I have. So my little makeshift work desk now, I always need a box of tissues, you know.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because I'm going to get emotional, just, you know, because there's always nose that need to be rubbed, or, you know, snots need to be cleared off, or food on someone's face that needs to be cleaned. So, yeah, always have tissues around.
That was Anna Fitzgerald on Bits of Me. You can follow Bits of Me on Instagram at bitsofme_podcast and on Twitter at bitsofme_pod. And if you want to help keep the conversation going to keep smashing stigmas, please sign up as a patron at patreon.com/bitsofme. This week, I want to extend a special thank you to the patrons Alison Gorman and Linda McConnell, and of course to you, as always, for listening.